Welcome to Emerge, a podcast-based inquiry into the people, ideas, organizations, and technologies creating a more beautiful future. I'm your host, Daniel Thorson, and my guest today is Chris Dancy. Chris has been called the most connected human on Earth and has been featured on Fox News, NPR, TechCrunch, Mashable, and Wired, among others. He is a contemplative platform designer, artist, philosopher, and writer. We talked about what it takes to design technology that promotes human well-being, the nature and cause of distraction and loneliness, the changing landscape of work, and how to survive a systemic collapse without hoarding bullets. Please enjoy this conversation with mindful cyborg, Chris Dancy. Welcome, Chris, to Emerge. I'm so happy to have you here. And as we kind of discussed beforehand, we'll just sort of let this conversation meander. We could probably talk for many hours about many different cool subjects. But first off, Chris, why don't you just give a little bit a taste of an introduction, who you are and what you do in the world?
So my name is Chris Dancy. I'm a 47-year-old Libra. I live in Nashville, Tennessee currently. Grew up in Maryland in a little town called Westminster for the first 25 years of my life. Relocated to Denver, Colorado for about 20 years, where I ran into a group called Buddhist Geeks about 3 years ago, maybe 4 years ago, and got involved in that community, started a more serious contemplative practice. Career-wise, I've been in IT my whole life. About 6 years ago, I started a life logging project, which got some notoriety in the media over the last 3-4 years. Switched to digital mobile health about a year and a half ago as a career from IT. I'm focused now on basically contemplative platforms, digital health, and non-dualistic species augmentation.
Okay, well, I'm just going to have to bite on that one. What is non-dualistic species augmentation?
Well, I'm finding that a lot of people that I deal with on a day-to-day basis are kind of falling into this camp of tech is making them better or tech is making them worse. And they're not really looking at the problem overall, which is their relationship with the process or the tool and the fact that they're inserting an I. There's a me in this process, like you are causing me to feel this way by your use of technology. So I think we could do a better job as a species and as designers and contemplatives and technologists to talk about radically transforming how we design technology to remove I and to insert us. And I think it's much different when you create something for me versus creating something for we. And it's a lot of soundbite blurby stuff, but it's really sound science behind it that I've been actively involved in crafting my own life.
What might that look like in terms of a product?
I think one of my favorite examples of designing for we instead of me is a great just app that I've used on iPhone for about 2 years called Insight Timer. It's a very simple app. I was turned onto it years ago. I stopped using it and I started using fancier and fancier and fancier things. They got me more into the kind of garish numbers that, you know, were the shamification of my own contemplative. It was the shamification of my own contemplative practice. And in reality, what I wanted to do was know that other people were contemplative with me. So there have been a lot of attempts to do digital sanghas, but I think Insight Timer, because it shows me a map of where everyone is when I'm meditating, when I finish, and it shows me how many people, and then their photos, it's multiple layers of perspective. So there's the geography layer. I mean, they could actually make it a little bit more interesting by just putting the light on it, so where's the sun at that moment. That there's the photo layer, there's the how many people I just meditated with layer. You know, they don't get into the kind of me against me until you go deeper into the program. So that, to me, I think is a really good example of how tools can create a sense of we instead of a sense of me.
Mm. That relates certainly to, like, I remember listening to you on Buddhist Geeks, and I'll link to this in the show notes, but thinking in relationship to the Buddhist concept of no self or not self, does seeing all of your personal data lead you to a more kind of flexible identification with yourself?
Yes, I think we need to be real careful about how we start talking about this now, because I just shot a special for Showtime and they were kind of blown away because they were like, that's not what we thought at all. Early on in the process, at about year three, so right when I met the Buddhist Geeks folks, I really was embracing my own behavior and my own nature to need to be contemplative at a pretty fast clip. I went from like zero to cushion in, you know, 3.5 seconds, and I had the data to prove it. The problem was I did it in 3.5 seconds and had the data to prove it. And this relationship with information became overwhelming, as I've talked about in interviews. But more than anything, it just taught me how quickly we weaponize facts to hurt other people, but in the long run, hurt ourselves. So I backed away at a pretty precipitate pace. I'm not backing away from collecting data. I'm backing away from how I interact with the information so that I can't hurt myself with it.
Right, right. Interesting. And so this, of course, clearly connects back to your, the first kind of supposition you made about getting rid of the I. So is your hypothesis then at this point that if we can sufficiently move from I to we, as you said,
I think we does a really good job of at least getting you out of your own head, right? Yeah. You know, gamification does a real nice job of saying, hey, you against your friends, and let's see what you've done. You know, shamification is when it's you against you or you against you in time. This is how bad you were last year. This is how good you are this year. And there's a lot of you. And when you spread you out temporally, you multiply in ego, because you're continuing to exist in all of these different states. And
yeah, you're reifying yourself. Yeah,
exactly. And I think we at least allows us a chance to go, okay, I'm only half as powerful as I used to be because there's someone else involved. But we has to be more than just me and someone else. It has to be me and a system. So, you know, me and money versus me and my money. Me and environments versus me and my weather. So that ring? Yeah.
I mean, so the next level then would be all.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Like, that's not quite possible yet, but it's headed in that direction. And I guess that was kind of what I was trying to feel into is, yeah, if you can see all the ripples from your behavior, does it reify the eye or does it pierce it? And it sounds like what you're saying is that most technology, most tracking technology these days is basically shamification. And reifies a sense of I in a kind of non-empowering way.
In a non-empowering way. But I think more importantly, most people can't use quantification effectively without hurting themselves. You just go back to just someone who reads books, right? They keep them and then they keep the books so they can apparently loan the books or so they can keep them on shelves. Some of the most powerful people I've met in the last year are people who read lots of books, but then hide them or just give them away right away. But the minute you can count something and save it, you can reflect upon it and then kind of glorify it or kind of personify it. So this is my body of knowledge. And there's much difference between having a body of knowledge that you can look at versus being a body of knowledge that acts upon the world. And I think a lot of people right now are starting to get into a lot of stuff I was doing 3-4 years ago when I was on Buddhist Geeks around, you know, people are just sharing every, you know, intimate part of their lives. And these intimate details, unlike our connected lives, are just that, they're intimate. And when you share them, you take away any real ability for you to have to learn from them. So when everybody is a digital flasher, wearing a raincoat with their sleep and their steps and their food intake underneath, you know, everybody's Johnson's hanging out and no one, all Johnson's the same. It just, I think it's really dangerous right now. And I like to think about it along the lines of, there's always a guiding principle for design. There's always a goal for design. There's a temporal identity for design. And then there's like the user face experience. And then there's the analog and digital versions of this. And there's even senses that come into it. So I always do it across a continuum: disruptive technology, calm technology, value technology, kind technology, and then contemplative technology. And that's really the spectrum in which you would design for.
Can we dive into that spectrum a little bit more? I'd like to hear just kind of, you know, top level, what each of those or the differences between each of those.
Sure. So disruptive tech, I mean, the main design principle is just to inform people, which is good. We all love to be informed. Calm tech is really about informing in the periphery. So it doesn't involve pulling you away from this current moment. So, you know, maybe an example of of, you know, disruptive tech would be a phone, a mobile phone alarm. But ComTech would be a periphery. So that could be something as simple as, you know, in you know, digital format, you know, maybe a light that changed with seasons, or if you really wanted super perspective, or a light that changed with time of day. From an analog example, you know, disruptive tech is a wristwatch, but comm tech is a sundial. So I think there's ways to do it. Value tech is really about, the kind of guiding principle in value tech is choice, right? So it's not about informing you or allowing you to have information in your periphery. It's about giving you choices that match your values. And when you think about that, an application, a digital version, I think a good example of this would be like Flux. So Flux is one of these small applications that lives on your Mac or your PC and matches your values to like not work 24 hours a day, right? I think, you know, there's a, you know, a pocket watch is a good example of value tech, right? So Flux is kind of the digital pocket watches, because pocket watches, unlike sundials, are very intimate. They're held close to your body. You can feel them ticking against you. So there's a lot of touch and vibration. Sundials give you a lot of perspective and space and time. Kind tech, unlike value tech, which is choice, is about perspective. So kindness really comes from massive amounts of perspective on your life, your own life. And for me, there's a really great digital example. There's a company called BioBeats, which basically uses your own behavior to create music to assist you in a task. Grandfather clocks, I think, are a great analog example. Unlike pocket watches or sundials or wristwatches, you can see how that's very distracting all the way out to like kind of these grand, you know, epic things. Grandfather clocks are usually handed down from generation to generation. They have the sound, they have the feeling, they have a scent. They're made of wood. They often have sun and moon and month clocks inside them. They're just majestic, I think, kind pieces of technology that invoke a lot of perspective. And the last thing on the wheel is contemplative tech. And that's technology that derives a sense of compassion for all beings. And when I think about, you know, designing that, you know, if the guiding principle is compassion, you know, an orrery would be a great analog example of that. So an orrery is just a moving solar system. You've probably seen them in science fairs. And they kind of give you a real sense of space and time, but also significance and compassion for all things. And I think that's really beautiful. A digital example of, I think, contemplative tech, the best we have right now would be something like Time Hop. And that basically is not very well because it's spreading just the kind of glorious eye across time. But they're starting to do better with it. And I think as they get more examples of that, they could do different things with it to connect you to other people without being shamification. But there's just some things in there.
And so it sounds like these kind of interweave a bit too. They're not distinct necessarily. Is that right?
No, I mean, you can't have comm tech informing you in the periphery without a disruptive nature.
Right.
You really can't have value tech. So you're still being informed, but you're being informed of what your values are. You can't really have kind tech with perspective without actually being given some sense of time and purpose. You really can't have contemplative tech inform you unless you have some sense of connectedness to other things.
Beautiful. That's really interesting. And maybe this is so there's kind of two interrelated questions or directions I'd like to go in. One is sort of what are the skills, because on the one hand, there's design, like we need to design better technology, but then there also seems like there's skill sets involved with using technology skillfully. Mm-hmm. So I'd like to talk a little bit about the skill sets. And in particular, we talked a little bit about this before the show started, but why are Buddhists in particular, in your view, so bad with technology? And this is something that I've noticed too. I've been, walking in Buddhist circles for maybe 8 years now, and it's just really, shocking and striking how bad we are with technology. And maybe you can go into that. Why is that?
I'm not sure. I went to the Wisdom 2.0. Well, let me just say right now, if Buddhists have a problem with what's going on, I mean, they really are the canary in the digital coal mine, because they're the people go to for answers about compassion, and they're the people they go to answers about being still and about being reflective and just about a journey of getting to be okay with not being okay. I tell my friends all the time who aren't Buddhists, they go, why do you meditate? I meditate so I become okay with not being okay, because neither one is true anyway. And I will never ever be permanently happy, and I'll never ever be permanently sad, and they both piss me off. Mm-hmm. So grief is really the currency of Buddhism. But for me, when I think about how the people at my Sangha, which are wonderful people, really struggle during our Dharma talks with, you know, how people are using technology, it's hard not to hear what's really going on, which is I'm not being paid attention to by others or by myself. Hmm. So they're doubling down on, like, wait, why aren't people talking to me? Why is everyone so distracted? And then they double down on, well, then I just distract myself. You know, there's so many talks, you know, about retreats where they bring in someone specific to bother people and to really help people become aware and, you know, sharpen and hone their practice. But yet we don't see the exact same glaring examples in our own lives. I'm going, oh, look how judgy I'm being with my use of my selfies.
Yeah.
And, you know, I called someone on the carpet for, you know, a couple years ago on Facebook who said, you know, he said, Chris, I think you're getting a little too obsessed with yourself. And I just literally just contacted them and said, hey, I think if you're obsessed with me being obsessed with me being upset and you're obsessed with that, then maybe you've got a bigger issue than, you know, than me. So, yeah, I mean, and I went to the Wisdom 2.0 conference last year and there's some amazing stuff going on there. But again, the conversations are about, you know, 4 or 5 years behind where the technology is. And so many Buddhists that I meet are more interested in exploiting the commercial viability of a Buddhist technology solution instead of a solution that's based on Buddhist technology.
What's the difference in that?
Well, I think if you build a tool that to help people become mindful is different than making people mindful of their tools.
What would that look like in practice? Making people mindful of their tools?
Well, again, I don't think that's up to people, right? You can't make people mindful of their food. You had to label it, right? So
yeah.
We have to just go back to 101 human, which is people just aren't by nature mindful, and that's the reason we have practice. But I do think as designers and as consumers, we can make better choices about how we design, how we interact with other people. You have to learn today, I think, to navigate around people are so busy being efficient that they've become indifferent. Hmm. Inefficiency is great if it doesn't result in someone being indifferent. And, you know, the opposite of love is not hate, it's indifference. And right now we have this vast amounts of indifference because we're going to make a bunch of time. So I guess back to the Buddhist thing. So my Sangha is great and I love them. But between my Sangha and Wisdom 2.0, I thought, oh my gosh, I need a contemplative community that's either, you know, doesn't think twice about this. Or one that's just like, we don't care. We're just, you know, the biohackers, you know, the contemplative biohackers, Mickey Siegel's consciousness hacking, right? They're totally basically mindful cyborgs. Mm. They have no problem. They're just cyborgs. And this is how a cyborg would be mindful, right? But there's, you know, these two camps, you know, that just kind of live out on the fringes. And then, you know, the middle people suffering are just really is what's hard for me. Mm.
And so what are the, this is a good time to talk about this. What are the kind of skills, the perhaps necessary but not sufficient skills to be in, you might say, like right relationship with our tools?
Well, they look a lot like the skills we do when we practice, right? Mm-hmm. I think there's just some insight you can do with your tools. You know, I do this thing at conferences now where I do something called iPhone palmistry. And all I do is I ask someone for their phone, and then I look at their phone, and I tell them what type of person I think they are. And it's kind of like palm reading, but it's different, right? It's just because it's silliness because it's an iPhone. But it's amazing how much if you just look at someone's phone, you can just tell a lot about them, like where their fingers rest on volume up and volume down, and how often they're, you know, touching their screen and where they're touching their screen just by actually using the reflection of the screen to see what types of things are on there. And then you turn it on and start to look for other things. And it does this amazing trick where it allows people to talk to you about what's important to them, because all you're doing is assuming what's important to them because everyone uses their phones pretty similarly. It's not like, you know, in Asia and North America and China that we all use touch screens differently. You know, this is technology flattened out culture. Hmm. So if we're all using and touching screens differently, then what can we learn from how we touch things? So I think that's really the first thing. It's about talking to each other about what values are. Because the technology is not going, right? The genie's out of the bottle. That's not going away. But if we can talk to each other about what's important to us, we can start to like solve the problem. And when I do this, I find out what's important to people are like two kind of big things, time and safety. Hmm. Right? They want to feel safe and they want to feel efficient. And efficiency comes in all sorts of ugliness. It's darkest, it looks like convenience. And at its best, it looks like maybe, you know, time management, just slightly relaxed. And it's awkward because I've yet to meet someone who's saved time and then used it to sit still. And I think until we talk about what are we saving? Every time I save time, I usually try to fill it up with something else so I can make more time, as if there's some, you know, puck on this giant ice skating rink of life that I'm skating toward. There's going to be this pool of time there once I save up enough of it. But that's just not the reality. And if I don't make the time to be with the puck when I'm hitting it, then I'm just going to forever be skating on this pond and have none of it. Mm-hmm. As far as skills, I mean, there's the stuff we learn in contemplative practice sitting, but we need to say, you know, I reminded my Sangha the other day that the cushions they were sitting on would have been seen as high, you know, super advanced technology 300-400 years ago. and, you know, certainly not sanctioned by anyone, right? Get off that, get on the floor. Yeah, we take it for granted today. So the biggest problem is we're not having a serious discussion about what do we do and how do we value time. But more important, I think, you know, kind of the elephant in the room is, you know, tools evolving faster than we are. Mm-hmm. We plowed earth as an agrarian society, you know, for tens of thousands of years before we actually domesticated animals to hook them to plows. And that was for, you know, thousands of years, not tens of thousands, right, before we actually turned it to a machine. And that was probably, you know, decades before we turned it into factory farming, which was, you know, 2 or 3 years before we turned into mass, you know, genetically modified seeds. But if you look at the information age, that didn't have hundreds of thousands of years, those tools to evolve. So they're just outpacing our ability. And we're all starting to act like system clocks, like overclocked CPUs. Ask someone a question, they auto answer it for you. Take someone's picture, they want to see it. Before you even have the phone, before you even click, okay, let me see it. You know, put a filter on it, you know, crop it this way, do it that way. Everyone's kind of living this director's version of their life, and they're not involved in their own narrative because they've turned into kind of these, you know, at best, you know, Buddhist reality TV stars, and at worst, reality TV stars.
I mean, when I talk to people about these sorts of topics, I often get the sense that there's this kind of fear, too, that things are changing so quickly and that they don't feel like they can keep up. And I see this especially with a lot of older people in different circles, not just Buddhist circles, but in different circles. And I even see it increasingly with people in my age range. And I guess I'm curious for you, if you ever feel scared at the potential.
Absolutely. I'm terrified. I'm screaming at the top of my lungs. You know, I was just doing a keynote the other day, last week, and I don't know when this will come out, but you know, I got a standing ovation at the end, right? Just because I said, you know, I'm terrified. I'm you know, I understand you all are lonely. We have an epidemic of suicide on our hands. Suicide is in the top 5 causes of death to every age group of white men up into the age of 65. Top three to the age of 30. Top 2 between 20 and 40. But yet we're not talking about what isolation is. And isolation is really this belief that you're all alone and no one's there with you and you're going to die that way. So a lot of time, a lot of self, a lot of ego. And really, what is tech isolation? Are we isolating ourselves? Is there a difference between distraction and isolation? And I'd say if you're in a room full of people and you're super distracted, you're probably the most isolated person there. So even at a party, you can be lonely, right? But there's a whole other thing if you're then lonely, you know, I'm going to go really digital dualism here. If you're at a party and you're lonely psychologically and organically, because, you know, no one's talking to you, but you're also then you double down on it by making sure you just spill yourself into your device. And what I've noticed was at bars nowadays, people will sit there and photograph their drinks completely alone. Just go to a bar in your city that you've never been to and just kind of watch from the corner. You'll watch people who photograph their drinks and photograph the bar and then post them online and then tag their feelings to them. And it's kind of like this whole value-based thing. If your feelings aren't trending, you don't have, you just don't fit in culturally. So all of a sudden you feel isolated that way. So, you know, all this data is allowing us to see mega trends, and they're allowing us to become temporally indifferent. You know, the other day I said, you know, we swipe to like, we click to love, you know, all this other kind of stuff that we touch to pay. But we don't really talk about, well, what is that doing? What's that completely take my behavior and digitize it? Like I have successfully, right? Mm-hmm. You know, patient zero. Well, it makes it really easy to judge your life even faster. And it goes back to what you said. people of all ages are suffering from this now, but we're not talking about what they're suffering from, because what they're suffering from, again, is the one thing Buddhists should do well, grief. Buddhists should be grief professionals, because impermanence is nothing more than grief on crack. Hmm. And until you can really, you know, necromance grief, it's just like, you forget it. Forget it. You know, it's just, you're going to sit there all day long focusing on your breath, sending love and kindness to the people you can't stand, you know, eating proper foods and cultivating the land, but you still haven't navigated the fact that it's all dying. You know, go listen to the fire sermon, you know, go read about it again.
Hmm. Say more. I guess you say that our kind of the Buddhist superpower is grief. You mean moving through grief in a way that transmutes it, or how do you mean that?
Well, grief is just the natural biological and psychological reaction to loss, and impermanence is loss. So I think unless we can talk about what are the biological and psychological symptoms of grief and how do we manifest them and organize them and be with them in an efficient way. If you want to figure out how to, you know, efficiently handle time, just look at some grief, right? Or force some into your life, or just become of how much actual suffering is going on. Then we're not going to do that. And I always felt like the one superpower I you know, borrowed from the community right away was everyone became a real expert at loss, or at least they talked about it. Maybe they didn't use those words, but for me, those are the words I took away was, wow. So, okay, if I'm suffering because I want things, that means I recognize things, you know, I'm striving for things. That means I recognize things are in the world, and in reality, they aren't. So what I need to get used to is, okay, everything's dying constantly, including me, including my beliefs.
Yeah, yeah.
It gets rid of the I real quick.
Is what you're saying, I just want to try to make sure I understand correctly, that the kind of behavior that we might say unwholesome or kind of like distracting behavior that people engage in with technology is because they haven't confronted their grief.
Exactly.
Okay. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me.
Exactly. I mean, I also FOMO.
Oh, totally. Yeah. And I noticed that when I get in an addictive relationship with my technology, it's because I'm not seeing something clearly, that I'm trying to distract myself from something that I don't want to feel.
Exactly.
Almost always.
That you don't want to feel. Right? That's key, right? And fear of missing out, fear of seeking, that seeking behavior is nothing more than, you know, it's like Lazarus for grief, right? Oh my gosh, oh my gosh, oh my gosh. Oh, okay, I found it. Whew, okay, you're still living. And you're just really inserting the eye in their heart at that point. You know, I'm going to miss this out. I'm going to miss that. I think, you know, we saw it first with kind of the documentation of our lives. Then we saw it with kind of the fear of missing out culture. We're seeing it now with the quantified self. And basically, all this just becomes lots of behavior that the internet that needs hyper-personalization is going to eat for lunch. And if you think you're isolated now, wait till you don't have to even blink to make things work, when things just happen for you. You know, Big Mother is going to just whoop your ass.
Wow. Yeah. I just got tingles. That's a wild future.
It's here. Personification is like a thing of the past now. All these companies, you know, billion-dollar companies can't function without your suffering. Facebook last week had 1 billion people logging in at the same time. And I thought to myself, at least 10% of those people were clinically suffering. Not even struggling or thriving, but probably clinically suffering. I would say, if it were Chris Dancy betting, I'd say 70% of those 1 billion people who logged in last week for the first time at the same time were clinically suffering. You know, you only need to get to 7 or 8% in a population at suffering for it to overthrow governments and to go into mass turmoil. And we're just seeing it. And the only thing that's keeping it at bay right now is this crack of distraction. I'm going to look at this. I'm going to do that. I'm going to focus on this. I'm going to focus on that. I'm organizing this startup. Everyone has $1 million idea. No one has a $10 problem.
What's a $10 problem?
It's everyday shit we deal with. Everyone has the $1 billion idea, but no one has the $10 problem. And they're like, let's talk about the $10 problems. I'm hungry. I'm bored. I don't feel like sitting. I need to exercise. I mean, all the stuff that like the real, you know, which is how many
I feel
people,
lonely, in other words, like real problems.
Real problems.
Real
right?
problems.
Okay. If you want to make a $1 billion company, look at Maslow's hierarchy of needs and work up from the bottom. We're building solutions for people who live like they're on Elysium.
Yeah, no, totally. It's I read an article that said that it's basically upper middle class white male nerds solving problems for themselves and then, you know, selling it to each other. Which
exactly.
Is,
San Francisco is a giant assisted living community.
That's fantastic. Yeah. Okay. So I guess I love, so maybe I can ask then, Do you feel like, so it sounds very much like the narrative that you went through, at least that you're reporting to me today, is that like you did this hyper quantification and kind of life logging with all these devices, you know, people called you the most connected man, and you discovered the suffering inherent in that, or at least that there is suffering in that.
Yeah, because what everyone is about to figure out is
right. Have you figured out a way to cross to the other side? I mean, in a Buddhist parlance, did you cross to the other side of the stream? And if you did, like, what's it like there? Or are you still kind of suffering from information
below? I'm still suffering because that's my nature.
But from this in particular, I mean.
No, in this point in particular, I think I am crossed. I do think I'm, you know, I put on Twitter the other day, I'm at the point where I'm carrying a burden I can no longer carry alone. I think people are going to find out very soon, as things become even more convenient, that the space between them and their ability to be uncomfortable is so small that they can't function. We're already treating each other so much more poorly.
Yeah.
Every time I go to a store, I almost get sick to my stomach having to pay. Because when I pay and I can't use a machine or self-checkout where I don't have to deal with a human, I have to deal with a human. And humans now, self-checkouts, are so apologetic. I'm sorry the system's slow. Or they're yelling, barking commands at you. Click the green button. Click debit or credit. Sign your name. They're just basically telling you what to do. And I so badly, it makes me actually sad. I just want to hand them my credit card and say, can we talk about your day? But you try to do that and it's like, no, the machine has to do this. So this, it's highly convenient, right? If you don't want to talk to someone, life is really simple. But as we make life super convenient, we realize one thing's true. We don't need each other. And when we don't need each other, the most fundamental part of grief stops functioning. And that's evolution. There's no friction when you don't need anyone. And when there's no friction, you don't evolve. You just become this gigantic psychological fat Buddhist mess that can't function without, you know, any bit of, you know, friction. Huh. And, you know, it's happening. It's almost like a bad movie I'm watching now out there.
Because you lived through it.
I lived through it. I saw how easy it was for me to say, I don't need anyone. And not only do I need anyone, I can become better without you.
And so if somebody is current, like somebody who's listening to this is currently swimming in that stream and is really recognizing themselves in what you're describing, what would you offer to them? What would you say that they should do?
Wow, I just got tight chest. That's responsibility. I think the first thing, I mean, if someone is listening, they are feeling that way. You just know you're not alone. Just like you are not alone. There are so many people dealing with this and they don't have the words to articulate it. So if you've never thought about why am I so sad and why is stuff so tough and why can't I get a break? You know, it is truly different than it was just 5 years ago. So don't be thinking that, you know, it's always been this. It's not. This is different. Everything's, you know, just try to buy gas without, you know, something digital involved. You just can't do it. But the second thing is really search out and find your tribe. You know, there are people, if you're willing to be socially courageous and talk to them and say, I'm feeling this way. Do you feel it also? And just having someone say, yeah, I feel it and I'm scared. Yeah, I'm scared too. You know, we can, now that we've saved our entire life, but we don't have the ability to look up any of it, it's scary. And the quantification's great, but only if you can retrieve it. You know, Wikipedia is wonderful because lots of people add to it and lots of people can access it. But you're not Wikipedia. Your Fitbit will never be Wikipedia unless you buy it back. Right? So, you know, all the quantification apps out there all cost a little bit of money. And then for data pro plans, it's all a little bit money more. What we're realizing very slowly is we've fed this machine all of our behavior and we're going to have to now buy it back. You created a student loan system on our own awareness. And the interest rates are astronomical and we will never get out of debt or find a job in the career world of getting to know you. So just focus on finding your tribe and connecting to each other and kind of riding it out. I don't think it's going to last more than 7 or 8 more years. It's breaking down as we see it. We can already see companies that are, the rise in messaging apps. Everyone's putting GIFs into their messaging apps or they're enabling emoji in their apps.
Yeah, how long can that actually last?
Exactly. So now I can express all of my feelings in one GIF instead of the 18 pages I used to have to manually write or the 2 paragraphs I would sometimes write or the one sentence I learned to write 6 years ago on Twitter. Or the, you know, the 13 characters I got it down to on a messaging or the one emoji or now the very complex GIF. you've compressed language to the point where you're suffering to actually speak. Or call me. I talk to people all the time. I sometimes think I have a crisis hotline just with the amount of people calling me going, I'm falling apart.
That's true. I got great advice from you, actually. It really clarified a lot. That's true, what you just said.
Yeah. No, I mean, just 720-936-9192. People call me all the time. If I can't take your call, I'll call you back as soon as I can. You know,
so it's okay for us to put that on the show?
You put anything you want in the show notes. You know, I cannot get enough people to become okay with not being okay fast enough. By the way, that used to be the job of, you know, sanghas and sitting.
Well, maybe we could switch gears a little bit, because I do want to talk about something that I think has been really important to me, which is the changing nature of work and career and livelihood. And I guess, you know, that was actually the advice that you gave me. You kind of just unloaded a little, you know, bomb in my head, basically, about how I think about career and how I think about what it means to get a job. And I think it's really confusing right now for young people who don't want to sell their souls, but want to make an impact and want to do something that's worth doing. And so I guess I'm just curious, like, maybe because we don't have too much time, like, what would your advice be to somebody who is in that position? They're looking out at a very confusing world, and they want to do something that doesn't feel gross and alienating, and they want to have an impact if possible.
I mean, I'm meeting a lot of young people who are doing amazing things and they're okay with it. Where they really seem to get in trouble is as soon as they try to, you know, figure out, can they make a living at it? And the problem is making a living is so different than what waging a living is, right? I think we wage war on this living idea that we have because of life. But the good news is so many people I see are actually doing a really good job with this. I mean, the best advice I can give someone right now is just keep your head low for, you know, 3, 4, 8 years tops. I know it sounds like a long time, but trust me, it's not. I'm 47. You can make it eight more years. I think that's the long end of this. And it all sort itself out.
Will it sort itself out? I'm curious. You've used that same time period or time horizon before. What's going to happen in 4 to 8 years?
I believe the system is breaking. It's breaking right now in front of us. I mean, you can only have so many people making this much money. You can only have so many people living in poverty in the richest nation in the world before the two are just, you know, too far apart. I think the rise of behavior as a digital means for people to be paid is on the horizon. You know, companies like, you know, Facebook and all the social media companies, they can't function without behavior. They can't sell ads without personalization. And personalization right now is suffering from ad block. It's suffering from you know, fake usernames, fake accounts. There's lots of things that are stripping away the power from personalization, and personalization can only get so strong. So I say 8 years because technology stopped evolving about a decade ago. What's evolving right now is commerce. Technology can only get so powerful. We're at the end. That ended, I'd say, 2007. We probably had the last big tech leap we needed, right? Once we had the MEMS we started putting into phones in 2009, which are these little sensors that read a lot of things. We don't have to worry about CPU power now, because now the data, we just the phone will collect. But now we have to really look at, well, what is happening? So it's the evolution of commerce and money. And that's a really dangerous thing, because you don't see money evolve. It just happens in the background. A lot of people like to talk about, oh, Bitcoin is just internet money. And no, Bitcoin is just really secret evil money that sounds really fancy, that a couple geeks, I mean, it's literally white man Uber for dollar bills, right? It's just, it's not real. If we understood what it was, which is computing power combined with kind of behavior tech, and this mass marketing engine, you'd say, okay, you know, Bitcoin is really no different than U.S. savings bonds, sold by a hipster. So, what do we do, right? So what can we do? So I think there's the kind of a buckle down. The other thing is, you know, don't rail against the machine, because I think right now a lot of people are suffering, not to use the proper use of that word, but struggling maybe. Because social justice has become such a meme, right? Mm. If you know, again, I go back to, if you don't have values without them trending, you don't have values. And, you know, Black Lives Matter, All Lives Matter, Ferguson, Ice Bucket Challenge, these are all cases of algorithms that crawled onto dry land, infected like a contagion the people around you. They became temporarily concerned about something. And then the media saw them, magnified it again. More people got involved. They crawled back out onto dry land, infected more people. And then slowly those people died off and were replaced with new values-based algorithm systems. So I think, you know, kind of laying low is one thing, but two is like not getting too involved in social justice. Stay like really local community stuff when you can. I definitely would get an apartment with at least 5 or 6 people, none of which make sure they have no desires for 5 years, right? Just like, we're just going to work and just hang out, right? We just got to get through this period right now.
But then, I mean, get through the period to the point where the system collapses? I mean, that seems
absolutely.
Like...
Absolutely. Absolutely.
But when the system, I mean, it seems like that would be you'd want... Or a lot of people might argue you want resources at that time. You want to be like really well prepared.
The people I think who are well prepared in a collapse like that are the people who are mindful and are considerate of each other, right? That's one group of people. Like, have you ever watched Walking Dead? I think it's, I can't remember what it's a zombie show.
Yeah, totally.
You know, those are people who really, you know, go from place to place to place and then focus on resources, then move to another place. And there's, you know, more of these dead people. But in the end, the one thing the show does really well is they show people caring for each other. And I think it's really funny that that show became such a hit in the same timeline as mobile phones. And if you look at the storyline, it just basically reads like iPhone event, iPhone event, iPhone event. Every season, every character, it's like some new feature. And there's not new features on phones as much as they announce features on people. Like, now you can do this, you know, I can or the phone can, which one, right? They went from saying the phone can do things in 2011 to you can in 2012. I've done it. Just do it. Freak yourself out a little bit. Look for the conspiracy. But I think if you focus on being the type of person who can take care of other people, but because you took care of yourself, then you can probably get through some type of collapse. You know, the way collapses usually work is there'll be some type of issue on the infrastructure or on the monetary system. There'll be some type of outage. But the real thing to start to watch for is martial law. So watch for them just shutting down cities overnight. Or just for a few hours, or just watch for that type of stuff. You know, when you start to see that happen in, you know, in the United States, you can know that it's getting close. Once they just put the whole thing under martial law and the government has to deploy troops, to, you know, keep big cities in check, you know, not the police militarization. We're already seeing early stages of this. We've already seen early martial law hidden in social justice movements. We're just not calling them martial law. Well, we do sometimes. Then at that point you have to go, okay, then what will they do with what's there? You know, is the currency systems are going? Is it the power grid? Is it the food supply? Is it some strand of health issue that's affecting people? Whatever it is, the people who will do well in those times, not the people who've saved up 800 gallons of water and 70,000 guns and they're hiding in their bunker. They're the people who actually will know how to go out and keep people calm and keep them okay with grief and loss. Mm-hmm. That's the only thing when the shit hits the fan that's going to help. Right, you don't want to be the last person on Earth with a bunch of guns and all this food. You'll be fat, blowing your brains out. I'd rather go fast helping someone who can't figure out what to do next because they've never had to do anything that wasn't delivered to them by a drone.
Yeah, that's I got tingles again. That's really I mean, I think about the people who are like prepping, and I'm like, there are fates worse than death.
Thinking you can survive a collapse is a fate worse than death.
The one question I'd like to ask you before we close up is, you know, just kind of surveying the world as a whole, your perspective on it. What do you see that has you most optimistic?
Forgiveness. It seems to be happening more often. Honesty seems to be a little bit more of it. People like Donald Trump, you know, say what you want about them, but he's forcing people to question, you know, what they believe in. People from all across the political spectrum, like Donald Trump. I mean, you could complain about that. You could not complain about that. But what that's saying is something can rally people. I think it's just kind of, there's a real resurgent in nostalgia. You know, you saw it with Facebook last year, introducing this, you know, 1 year ago, 2 years ago. There's a real resurgent in, you know, services now they're offering to do things with your memories. So I think I'm really hopeful because that's the one thing that is instant perspective. If you don't share it, by the way, it's like you can be the most caring person in the world and give to charity. But like if you tweet your Kiva donation, you're just a douche who donated to Kiva, right? You just, that's That's not very kind at all, right? But just like you have to get your memories back and you have to not reshare them. At some point, and it's happening, people are making intimate information intimate again. And big data isn't winning. Data that involves just me and myself, and no one will ever know how I feel, is winning.